All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here with verse 40, continuing the events that surrounded the final stages of the crucifixion. Here, now that it's actually over, Jesus is dead. The two criminals are still alive at this point, but they will be taken and dispatched shortly to their phase 3. But this confession by the centurion is now moves to another scene that Mark wants to focus on. And in fact, from here on, the women here introduced become the focal point of the rest of the book. Not that he doesn't mention other things, he does. But these women play a critical part in all of this. There were also, in verse 40 now, some women looking on from a distance. But, or now, it's not actually translated, there were, imperfect indicative of I me, third person plural here, it's a paraphrastic construction. This imperfect of the to be verb, I me, actually goes with the verb theoreo, which is going to follow. If you see the little plus there at the end of the parsing for I me, and that's just what that is in those parentheses, it just tells you it's a verb, indicative, imperfect, active, third person plural. And that plus, if you look down at the verb theoreo, which is in the next end of the next line, you see the plus with it. It tells you that those two are linked together actually in the Greek thought. So there were also chi here used in an adjunctive sense. In addition, there were also women, and they supplied the word here, some women, because it is indefinite here, gune, but again, the real emphasis on this is that they were women, not looking on from a distance and not men. From a distance is a preposition here, apo with A-P-O. With the adverb, or actually here it functions more as an adjective, but it's typically an adverb, makrothen, M-A-K-R-O-T-H-E-N, literally means from afar, or from a good distance, observing. They translated this here, looking. Blepo would really be looking. I like the idea of observing better, not that it's a huge difference, theoreo. Because this verb, there are several verbs in the Greek for sight and for perception. And this means to observe something with close attention, to be a spectator, like you would be a spectator at a football game. You're not just sitting there seeing what's happening, you're engaged with it. If you're a fan, you would be engaged with it. And again, this word means to not only see something, but to consider what you're seeing. Our word theorize comes from this, or theory. And one does not have a theory apart from some observation that leads them to that. And so they were looking on. Again, this indicates, again, the paraphrastic construction just means to use more words than is necessary to communicate the same thought. It's being wordy intentionally. They were in a state of observing or spectating all these events. Among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joses and Salome. Among whom is probably better, and here with the locative of the relative pronoun hosts. Among whom were, and then what you have here is you've got a chi that's going to be repeated, and it's not necessarily translated here, in every instance, but what it does is it just connects all these together and lets you know that he's looking at this as a group of individual people, among whom were Mary, the one from Magdala, the Magdalene, M-A-G-D-A-L-E-N-E. That just means the Magdalene is like the one from Magdala. It's a region. It's a geographic designation. And Maria, again Mary, the mother, Mater, of James, Iokabas. Jacob is actually how we would probably transliterate that word, but the word Jacob and James are the same word as far as the Greek there is considered. James, the, and then you got this at genitive defining him, homikros. M-I-K-R-O-S. Like our word micron comes from this. Micron is a very small particle. Or micro, that which is small. So this refers to that which is limited in size. It can also mean small. It can mean less. It can mean short. It can mean younger. We don't know what exactly it means in this context. We'll give you the best shots we have at it. But it doesn't really say here, and he's not specific. Mary, the mother of James, the less, and of Joseph, Iosace in the Greek, and Salome. And by the way, Mary, the mother of James, the less, and Joseph, those are both genitives, so those are both her children. These are genitives of relationship. So there's not here, you got Mary Magdalene, and then Mary, the mother, and then Salome. There's only three women he's talking about, and then there's the two children, and he only uses the children, one would expect, because the reader somehow knew of these people. There's no reason to use these names unless they have some significance, both for Mark and likely for his audience. So when he was, and then Salome is just exactly a translation of the Greek Salome. Salome. When he was in Galilee, they used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. And they haven't really translated this here, but what you have is this relative pronoun host introduces this. A reference back, you've got the nominative feminine plural, to these three women. Which women? You've got a temporal conjunction here, hata, which means when, at which time. He was, imperfect indicative, looking back into the past of Imi, when he was in Galilee. Galilea is the word, and that just means the province of Galilee. When he was in the province of Galilee, they were following him. You have, again, an imperfect of akolutheo, A-K-O-L-O-U-T-H-E-O. And akolutheo means exactly that, to follow someone. And it can be used in both a physical, literal sense of following someone, like you follow someone out the door. Or we have seen Jesus use this in the sense of follow as a disciple. In fact, back, I believe, in Mark 8, if I'm right here. Yeah. Mark 8:34. He talks about he who wishes to follow me literally is to come behind me. And there in that sense, obviously, he's not only talking about a physical following, being behind him, but to follow him as a disciple. If anyone wishes to come after me, i.e. be my disciple, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And there in the sense not only of following physically, I mean, obviously that's true, but we can't follow him physically anymore. You have to follow him spiritually. And so this word is used here of following as a disciple. They used to follow him, in other words, and you've got the imperfect here of akolutheo, which should be viewed as a customary or habitual imperfect. This was what they did regularly. This wasn't just a one-shot deal. They were continually following him, autos, referring to Jesus. Following after him, dative, and ministering to him. Again, we would view this as another customary or habitual imperfect of diakoneo. D-I-A-K-O-N-E-O. And as you probably know, diakonos, our word for deacon, comes from this. And diakoneo means literally to minister or to serve or to attend to someone. Its most basic meaning was used of that of waiting on tables. And there is probably some sense in all of this, of which when they followed him and were ministering to him, this would have involved cooking meals, things that they needed, possibly cleaning, washing clothes. We don't know what all they did. We do know that they're not mentioned really, hardly until now, that these women do not get a lot of airtime in the Gospels. And yet, they're apparently have been critical to the ministry of Jesus without being mentioned. And given what we know of these male-dominated societies, women were often treated as second-class citizens, but clearly Jesus did not. Jesus did not look at women as second-class citizens. And Mark, obviously, here, because he chooses to include all this, certainly does not. But by now, they've realized, these not only the disciples, Mark is not, he may not have been a disciple at this time, we don't really know. Some have suggested that he was, that he followed Jesus. Again, some have suggested he was that guy that got ran off there in the garden, who fled, wearing only a sheet, and then ran off naked. We don't really know if that was him or not. Some have suggested that his mother's house was the upper room, where they met for the final supper, but we don't know that. Again, so we don't really know how involved even Mark was as a disciple at this point. But what becomes clear to these guys after the fact is that when all this comes down, it's the women that stood out. It's not the men. It's the women that made the applications. It's not the men. The men were hiding for their lives. Peter had fled for his life. They'd all fled for their lives. Peter had denied him and ran off. John is apparently the only disciple present at the cross. None of the others are mentioned. And even he's not given a lot of press there. It's just mentioned in passing that there was the disciple, that he was there, and that he had to become responsible for Mary. So they used to minister to him, again, to him, dative of advantage here, to Jesus. And others, many. There were many other women. And the important thing here is that these are nominative feminine plurals. Of Alas, others, and then Paulus, many. But the fact that they're feminine tells us he's talking about women and not just disciples at large. And there were many other women who came with him to Jerusalem. Soon Anabino is a triple compound here. It's only used twice. Soon, Sunanabaino. This means to go. Ana means up. And then soon means with. So to go up, they came up with him, i.e. to ascend. And this is why when you see directions in the Bible, particularly when it revolves around Jerusalem, Jerusalem's set on the top of a mountain. And Mount Zion. And everything from Jerusalem was down. And when you were going to Jerusalem, you had to ascend, you had to go up. And so these directions are not like we would say, you know, going up or down. We would mean north or south. They don't. So they ascended or came up together with him, instrumental accompaniment here, him, Jesus, into Jerusalem. So point one here, some interpreters like to link these two verses with what preceded. Since they might naturally seem to form the conclusion of the events at Golgotha. However, point two, these women are introduced here because these verses serve as a bridge to the very important events that will occur later in this chapter and in the next one. And in verse 47, the very critical event that is seen there is that when Joseph of Arimathea gets the body from Pilate, Mary Magdalene and at least the other Mary, Mary the mother of Joseph, were looking on. So they form an eyewitness link to the fact that we know where the tomb is. That they knew where the tomb was. This is critical because what is one of the major suggestions that why the resurrection was viewed as a reality when in fact it was false, and that is they went to the wrong tomb. Well, no, these women proved they couldn't have. I mean, they were standing right there looking on, just as they were looking on from the cross. Not one interpreter that I know of suggests that they did not see the events of the cross. Again, they don't understand Jesus' bearing sins. I get all that. But they saw the whole thing and they knew right where it was. And verse 47 is critical because that once again, they're presented just as spectators who see what's happening and know precisely where it's happening. Now, they may not understand the why of all of it, but they don't have to. They're just there. So when one argues the Sabbath was over in chapter 16, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, the same three women we're introduced to here, brought spices so they might come and anoint him. And they not only are eyewitnesses of where the tomb is, one of the things you see that they didn't think this through very well. Well, that should not be shocking for a bunch of reasons. And not just because they're women. So I've seen people make that, well, they're women, they didn't think ahead. Like, no, women never think ahead, men always do. No, I don't think so. That we've seen with the disciples, they couldn't think beyond the ends of their nose sometimes. We've seen that throughout this book of Mark, who present the disciples in the most unflattering of lights of all the Gospels. And they were saying, verse 3, to one another, who will roll away the stone for us? Because they not only had seen where the place was, they'd seen how the grave was sealed. And that is found up actually chapter 15 there, verse 46. He rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. And so they have observed all this. And so they know they're going to the right place. They know where it's at. To attribute stupidity to them is just, to me, trying to get around the very obvious facts that this all happened the way the writers say it did. So, three, these women are introduced here since they are the only actual witnesses to the critical events that follow, which include the burial and the resurrection. And four, it is only from John's account that one recognizes that he and Mary, the mother of Jesus, were present at the cross. However, they apparently do not remain for the burial. John 26. And they're probably, from my reading of this, that they're in much greater proximity to the cross than that these women who are standing at a distance are. What the distance is, we don't know. But it's presumed that if Jesus is talking to Mary and John, that they are in close enough proximity, he's being crucified, he's in agony, that they're close enough to hear him easily. That to me has always been the sense of this, that Mary and John were there, and they could readily hear Jesus, and he could readily speak to them. And it's not that Jesus couldn't have shouted to them from across the valley or whatever, but the fact, it seems to me, is that they were much, much closer. Because he says, standing by the cross, whereas Mark makes this deal, standing from afar off. So, John and Mary are there. Okay. Of Jesus were his mother. And his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. So she's presented now, in John's account, as being in the same proximity as Mary and John are. Now, what I think happens is, my best guess at this, is that once Jesus dies, normal people are going to get the mother out of there. I mean, it's bad enough that she has to stand there and witness her son dying. The most ignominious of deaths. That she has to see all this and live through it. That's difficult enough. But one would presume that once the death was over, that they would get Mary out of there. And I think this is why Mary Magdalene here, for instance, and this other Mary, but see, well, one of the questions becomes, and we'll have to deal with all of this, is this Mary the wife of Clopas, the same Mary that's the father, or the mother rather, of James the Less and Joseph? And that's a question that has to be addressed. But my thinking is, when they're near to the cross there, they're there for support of the family. They're related, for one thing. As it says, his mother's sister. And that also poses a problem exegetically that we will address in all of this. And that is, how many women are here in John's account? Is it his mother, his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene? That would make four. Or is his mother's sister defined as Mary the wife of Clopas? We're not really told. So anyway, but as soon as the death, you know, and of course then Jesus, when he saw his mother and the disciple, whom he loved, standing nearby, he said, "Woman, behold your son." And he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. And this is right before the actual time of death. So as soon as he dies, my guess is that they're going to get Mary out of there. But that some of these other women hang around. And that's why Mark has them afar off, whereas John has them in great proximity to the cross. I think that both are true. That there was a period where they were right there, and then as Mary gets led out, away from all of this, that these women withdraw as well. They have no reason to stand there either, any longer. But that they watch all this from a distance. Then later on. And so some pause to see, look, there's a contradiction here. John says they're right by the cross. Mark says they're a ways off. I just think it's that they're both true, that they were right by the cross initially. And then once it's all over with, they back off. So it is only from John's account, again, that one recognizes that he and Mary, the mother of Jesus, were present at the cross. However, they apparently do not remain for the burial. That, to me, makes kind of normal sense. There's nothing to be gained. And plus, at this point, once he dies, there's no telling when they're going to take him down from the cross. That he could just hang there dead for hours. What's the point of standing there? What does that do for you? Nothing. Only adds to the agony of the moment, I would think. So 5, for those who seek to undermine the veracity of the historical accounts of Jesus' life and death, the presence of these women forms a very formidable problem. And 6, any suggestion that there was some sort of historical error about the matter of Jesus' death or the place he was buried must be rejected if one is to accept the fact that these women were eyewitnesses to these critical facts. And they were. I mean, this is how they're presented. And no one's really ever effectively proven that this isn't true, that just the way this is recorded here isn't true. As France has keenly observed, point 7, the appearance of this group of women at this point in Mark's narrative demonstrates a remarkable shift in emphasis. And 8, if one had no other account than that of Mark, he might reasonably conclude that Jesus' ministry was only comprised of males, since there is no indication that women either accompanied Jesus or participated in any way in his ministry. And 9, although there have been women mentioned in Mark's account, they, like so many others, were simply the recipients of Jesus' actions. The only time a woman is mentioned outside of that is the anonymous woman who anointed Jesus. Now, I say anonymous because Mark leaves her anonymous, but we know from the other account that it was Mary that did this. That was seen, we saw that in Mark 14, 3 through 9, while he was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, there comes this woman in. And this account very clearly has to be placed as a parallel to John 12, where Mary is actually identified. And this is actually Mary, the sister of Lazarus, it appears. But again, the mistake people make in reading John is that they presume that Jesus is in Lazarus' house, and they're not. They're not in Lazarus' house. Mark makes it plain they're in the house of Simon the leper. So when one again starts to combine these accounts and pick out the realities of what's going on here, then he has to come to the suggestion here that they come to the conclusion, rather, in John, that they're in one place when in fact they're not. And that's pretty evident that both Jesus and Lazarus are sort of guests of honor, equal sort of guests of honor here. Why? Because this raising of Lazarus occurred not very long before all this. I mean, it may have been days, it may have been weeks, but it wasn't long at all before this. Probably measured in terms of days. But again, we don't know how long Jesus withdrew out of that area. We're told that he did and went to Ephraim, that little city up there sort of north of Jerusalem. But we're not told how long he was there. So this whole thing serves, again, they don't stop and pay attention to the details, and it gets them into trouble interpretatively. So again, if one mentions this, The only mention of a woman doing anything of any significance in all of Mark was this anointing with that very expensive, a year's worth of ointment or perfume or oil, as it's called. Well, 10, it is only now that Mark lets the reader know that there have been a significant number of women that had actually accompanied Jesus and served him over the course of his ministry in Galilee. And ironically, these women are not mentioned until all the significant male followers have abandoned Jesus and left him to his fate. In 12, only John records the fact that there was one man, him, at the crucifixion, John himself, John the Apostle. And all the other accounts lead the reader to believe that the apostles had abandoned Jesus at Gethsemane and have not been seen since. The only one we knew that had been seen since was Peter and John there at the house of Caiaphas. Again, the courtyard there that Caiaphas and Annas likely share. So Peter's the only one we've seen, and he doesn't come across very well in the event in which we see Peter. He's not, you know, looked at as an example of anything other than cowardice and fulfilling the prophecy that Jesus said he would fulfill. So 13, the reader is not told how, why, or when these women became informed about the condemnation of Jesus. But it does not appear that there had been any women present at his arrest. There's no indication of this. Jesus appears to be only with the disciples. The upper room scenario doesn't seem to mention any women at all ever. And then when they withdraw from there, they go immediately outside the city. We know that it's late at night, probably approaching midnight or later. And so there's no indication that any of these women were present for any of this. But next day, somehow, as these people are familiar with Jesus, and if they followed him to Jerusalem specifically, the next morning when they get up, they're probably going to seek him out pretty quickly. And so they will find out very fast what's gone on over the night, over the course of the night. And then by the time they get him to the cross, I would think that a lot of this news has spread throughout the city, even. Because Jesus has been the talk of the town, and it's clear that with the conflict that existed between Jesus and the religious leaders, that this was a big subject of conversation. It was the, quote, big news of the day. And so you know how people are with the big news of the day. It's, you know, that's the first thing they talk about. So I don't have any problem with the women, even though they're not present, finding out pretty quickly what's going on, particularly since they seem to have been pretty highly involved with Jesus. So, again, there don't appear to be any women present at the arrest. 14, perhaps some of the apostles who may not have been able to sleep that night. Would you have been able to sleep after all this? I mean, I have trouble sleeping. Like last night, and I don't know why, but about once a month, our electric will go off for 5 minutes in the middle of the night. So all of a sudden, my fan goes off. The battery backups start beeping throughout the house. And, you know, I have to get up and turn all that off. And then it'll come, about the time I get them all off, it comes back on. And well, it takes me a while after that to get back to sleep. Well, and that's not even a real trauma. That's what I'm kind of pointing out. That this is not a real trauma compared to what these people are going through. And I had a difficult time sleeping after that. Well, after all that they had seen. And of course, the disciples are worn out. We get that. I do know that they are beat. Jesus has led them on a grueling ministry that has taken a lot of the steam out of these guys. But again, with all the events going on, the fear of the Romans coming, would you be able to sleep? I don't think most of them probably did. Or if they did, they probably didn't sleep very well. So my suspicion is, again, they may not have been able to sleep that. Where did they go? I mean, they're fleeing for their lives. Did they stay outside Jerusalem? Did they go back to Bethany? Did they realize we're going to be in danger if we go to the city? Did some of them, we're not told, but we know Peter and John followed from a great distance. Were some of them even following from a further? I mean, we don't know. We don't know what happened to the bulk of them. So perhaps, again, they might have sought refuge among these women when they fled for their life. They may have known where the women were staying. They may have known. Of course, this is late at night. I mean, now we're talking 2 or 3 in the morning. You better be pretty friendly with people to show up on their doorstep at 2 or 3 in the morning. You better have a fairly decent relationship with them, I would think. Well, at any rate, we don't know how all this happened, but I presume that some of this knowledge came to them through these disciples who had, you know, ran off at some point and stayed not visible in the circumstances. So, at any rate, these women had become aware of Jesus' circumstances, as has his mother, and had apparently been following the proceedings to this point. Now, that doesn't mean they had to be there at 6 o'clock or whatever it was, 6:30, when they first get to Pilate's house. It's very unlikely that anybody was there then. But as people begin to rise in the morning and get up and wonder, and there's a commotion. Obviously, there's some commotion out there. The Bema Seat was an open public forum. And so if one lived in any proximity to there, he could hear, you know, what was going on. And so I don't have any problem with him at 7, 8, whatever time o'clock it was, 9 even, finding out about what all's going on and becoming, or they may have found out about the crucifixion after Jesus was on the cross. There's nothing to prevent that either. We're just not told when they became aware of all of this. Well, 16, these women are differentiated from those that were close to the cross in that they are said to be observing all this from a distance. The fact that they remain at a distance, but again, as we pointed out in John's account, that some of these women were close by to start with. So some, many interpreters say, well, they were afraid, so they stood off. And that's a natural response, one might think. But knowing that they had been in proximity, it seems to me more that when they withdrew, obviously there's probably some fear. You can't, I don't think, rule that out completely. But when they withdrew, there's no reason to stand there. And then they just want to see how it's all going to play out. Now, I could see where his mother would not want to. That to me makes sense, that you would get her away from all of this. However, they do not allow their emotions to keep them from watching what happens. They remain at a distance and carefully observe what is happening. That should be what is happening. The verb theoreo, looking on, means to observe something with sustained attention. To observe something as a, that should be spectator. I don't know about your notes, but mine are bad there. As a spectator. Point 19, it is derived, that is the first three sentences of the words of the next sentence. It is derived from the verb theaomai, which is has the idea of looking at something attentively, to contemplate what one is seeing. The verb is used in a Greek writing, of viewing public shows. And it is the root word of our term theater. So when you go, it's like when you go to a movie, you observe, you know, a lot of things. The more details you can observe about what's happening, obviously, the more you get out of the movie or the play, or in this case, it would have been live performances in the Greek culture. And so here again, theaomai is where we get our word theater from. So 20, although there is really nothing more that they can do but watch. Their presence at these key events and their attentive observation of them will form the basis for their place as witnesses of the historical realities of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And although many people now deny, I've heard this statement recently, well, eyewitness testimony is not very good. It's the least preferred form. It's never been that historically. Historically, all people, the best testimony was eyewitness testimony. That someone was there and saw the events. And if you were present at this, that's giving far greater weight. Even though they say, well, people are dumb and they don't see things and they don't think through things and they get their details mixed up. Well, that can all be true. But it doesn't still mean that eyewitness testimony isn't what you want. It seems to me that that is what you want. So again, there's nothing they can do but watch, and they form the basis for all this. The 21, Mark mentions three specific women who were part of a larger group that was present. Only Luke indicates that there may have been male acquaintances of Jesus in this group as well. Luke 23:49, he's the only one. Matthew and Mark all indicate it was just women. Luke 23:49. And it's that phrase, all his acquaintances. That's not specifically just feminine in the Greek. That is open. It's a masculine. And literally all it is in the Greek, you got the adjective pos, nominative masculine singular, or pardon me, nominative masculine plural. And then the ones knowing him, which is, again, a nominative plural. And it doesn't tell us, it just talks about, in general terms, those who knew him. So from Luke's account, we can say there's a possibility that there are some males present, but we don't know if there were or not. I mean, this could have been comprised strictly of females. But it seems from what he says in verse 49, all his acquaintances and the women who accompanied him. So he's certainly singling out these women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance. And again, Luke's an indication here to me is kind of Luke fills in a little bit of that gap that I told you about between the time when they're all at the cross and then they move off to a distance and continue to observe. If you look in Luke 23:48, and all the crowds who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breasts. And that's a sign of sorrow or mourning. So these would appear to be Jesus sympathizers that are returning, and that are, once this is all over, and when Jesus dies there at about 3 o'clock, the show's over, folks. That's what you've come out here to see. I mean, for good, bad, or otherwise, I'm not saying it's bad that they came out to see it. For some people, it was just a spectacle. It was just something to entertain or to, you know, brighten their day or whatever it was. And for other people, it was horrible. It was critically awful for them to be there. So there's this period where they're moving away. And this is where I think the women stop and decide, well, let's see how all this plays out. So here, maybe their natural curiosity got the best of them. Sometimes curiosity can be an okay thing. Other times it can get you into a lot of trouble. Particularly inordinate curiosity, where you want to know things that you really don't need to know. So again, I think Luke gives you sort of a gap here and sort of fills in how these women get from being right at the cross to being a ways off. And they stop and observe all this. So again, Mark mentions three women, but Luke suggests at least it leaves open that there may have been some males in this group. Maybe there were. It seems that there might have been, but I can't say definitively. 22, while Luke omits any reference to particular women, Matthew and Mark list three, from which one can deduce that Salome is the mother of James and John. And if you compare what we have there in Mark, I should have put the Matthew verse here. It's Matthew 27. We get an alternative spelling in Matthew 27:56. Well, actually 55, he says. Now, there were women who were looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee while ministering to him. And in 26, we get Mary Magdalene. Okay, we know that. She's identified clearly in both accounts. You get Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Joseph is just an alternate spelling for Joseph. That's not a problem there. It's the same Mary. And then you get Salome in Mark's account, but here she's called the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And so that's the only way we can figure that out is by comparing the two accounts. Well, 23, again, as I pointed out, John appears to list four women in his account, although that question is still being debated. Back to John's account now, in John 19. The question arises, as to whether he's mentioning three women, well, his mother and his mother's sister. And now, is Mary the wife of Clopas, his mother's sister, or is she a different woman, and Mary Magdalene? One thing we know for certain is that all the accounts are very consistent. Mary Magdalene was there. There's just no way anybody can debate that. Well, if he does list four women, which seems to be the most probable interpretation, they would be Mary, the sister of his mother, Mary of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene in John 19:25. 25, if the lists in these three Gospels are referencing the same women, then Salome, the mother of James and John, was likely the sister of Mary. This would have meant that Jesus, James, and John were cousins. And as it turns out, That's probably the most likely circumstance. And one of the things that you understand now, if that becomes the reality, which I think it is that why certain of these people like Peter, James, and John occupied maybe a greater position with Jesus. And this would have been, as you know, especially James and John, if they were cousins, and they tried to do that end round that they did, you know, where they had their mother go in and say, "Hey, just, I want you to do me one little favor. You know, just give me everything I ask for. Just make my sons the greatest of all." Well, if they were cousins, you can see where that would create even more friction within the group. Because as we all know, nepotism begins at home. And so, this may have been viewed as Jesus and his little band of relatives. And of course, that is a very intriguing observation, because in many cases, when you get into local churches, people, like, they think that way. I've seen this before in local churches. Not maybe so much here, thank God. That, oh, well, these people are related, so they've got their little deal, and they've formed their little power structure, and they've got their little agenda, and we're on the outside. Well, that's not true. It was not true in Jesus' ministry. Even though maybe if James and John thought it was true that they had some kind of an in with Jesus because they were his cousins, well, they'd sadly misread him, because we know that he was not a respecter of persons. And you did not, show favoritism to anybody. Jesus didn't, certainly. So, again, if these are referencing the same women, this would have meant that Jesus and James and John were cousins. Now, if there are four women listed, it would also mean that Mary of Clopas. And the meaning of that genitive is debated. But most likely it's taken, and that's the way most interpreters translate it, is Mary the wife of Clopas. But it's hard to tell, because a genitive is a very vague form in the Greek, and there's probably 20 different ways a genitive can be used. And again, what you have to do is sort of whittle down, well, what is it not? You can eliminate a bunch of them. But this Mary of Clopas is most likely a genitive of some kind of relationship. But it could mean Mary the mother of Clopas, or it could mean Mary of Clopas, i.e. Mary the wife of Clopas, which is the more likely, in my opinion. So she was to be identified as the wife of Alphaeus. Because, again, when you get into all of this, you realize, well, wait a minute, some of these questions aren't all that easy. You've got these four accounts, and you have to harmonize them at some level and sort of figure out, well, okay, why did they refer to these people in different ways? But that's also typical human nature. Not everybody refers to everybody the same way. Well, 27, the fact that John would not mention the name of his mother is consistent with the anonymous style in which he writes, never mentioning himself or those in his family. Now that, in the Gospel of John, that's easily enough explained. Because John, if he's identifying his mother's sister, and that's Salome, which I think is the most likely deal, he wouldn't identify his mother, because John never identifies himself or his relatives at all in his Gospel. He always leaves them anonymous. Because by the time John writes this, he's recognized that these earthly relationships mean nothing. That they're not the focal point of God's plan. So whether you're cousins or aunts or uncles or nephews or nieces or whatever, that doesn't enter into any of this. Well, 28, the first woman Mark mentions is Mary Magdalene, who was differentiated from others named Mary. It was a very common name, still is. By naming her hometown Magdala. And that would include all forms of Mary: Mary, Maria, Miriam. Those are all just derivations of the same basic root name. Magdala was a major port on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, and was a center of trade and commerce. It is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew Migdol. A watch or a watchtower. And that actually, in Migdol there, that should be M-I-G-H-D-O-L. That's a comments atuf. That should be a D-O-L, not D-A-L. But that's a small thing, but we can change that in the notes. Migdol. Mary had been severely demonized. And Jesus had performed an exorcism during which he removed seven demons from her. This information is unique to Luke. Luke 8:2. And here, Luke sort of mentions in passing, he doesn't play it up any, but he does mention in passing, in verse 1, he says, the 12 were with him, at the end of verse 1, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and sicknesses. But they're just kind of glossed over in all this. I mean, you just wouldn't, it was not his focus, pretty clearly, but he does mention them. Among whom, Mary, who was called Magdalene, again, a citizen of Magdala, from whom seven demons had gone out. And Joanna, now he gets more specific, the wife of Chuza, who was Herod's steward. So this is Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, and she's the wife of Herod's steward. So she's a pretty well-to-do woman, as we're going to find out. And Susanna, we don't know who she is. And many others who were contributing to their support out of their private means. So another thing we find out when it talks about these women who had been following him in Galilee and ministering to him, was it wasn't just cooking and cleaning and all of that. They were giving him money. They were supporting this ministry financially. And these were, as it was going to turn out, fairly well-to-do women. I mean, I know I, when I first didn't study the Gospels carefully, I mean, back when I was a fundy, and of course we were never really instructed that well, but it was kind of my view that all these people that sort of resorted to Jesus were all down and outers. They were fishermen. Now we knew that Matthew was a tax collector. He was probably well-to-do. But as it turns out, when you consider it, John's family, John, James, and Peter there, who was their associate, his family had to be pretty well-to-do. They had a lucrative fishing business. And while you know, may not get rich fishing, you can do pretty well. And so my view, you know, there was always these people, and this is, you know, my mistake, that these were just, you know, the riffraff of society would follow him, the lepers, the lame, the blind, you know, the really lame, period, not physically lame, that all these people were lame, and they weren't. There were some very prominent people involved in this. And as you might imagine, that is going to create even more hostility toward Jesus if word gets out that these women are supporting him. Particularly the wife of Herod's steward, that would have been problematic, I think. How do you deal with Herod when Jesus appears to be a rival? And you're working and living, you know, there's very possibility they lived and worked with inside the palace of Herod himself if he was his steward. So she, you know, had some pretty cushy surroundings, and yet she chooses to identify herself with this itinerant preacher from Galilee, Jesus. So we find out here that Mary had been severely demonized, no doubt fully demon-possessed in every sense of the word, and goes out. Well, unfortunately, in about 591 A.D., Pope Gregory the Great identified her with a penitent prostitute in Luke 7. And that faulty identification continued to be accepted for some time. Why he does this, well, he's a pope. He just, you know, he can do anything he wants. But there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in Jesus' house, sinner in this context has the idea of immoral, prostitute, that she was a woman of the streets. She brings this alabaster vial of perfume. And all of this. And so throughout all this, if you even read the whole account, you don't have to at this point. But Simon, you know, gets the idea of, well, God, Jesus can't be very astute or he'd know this woman was a hooker. She's a hooker. I just thought I was doing great. As Arthur would say. And then he tells him this parable, but nowhere in here is this woman ever identified at all. And then Luke clearly advances the narrative in chapter 8, verse 1, when he said, soon afterward. I mean, this is way away from that context. It may have been a day or two or three, but it's not the same context at all. And so Gregory, for whatever reason, he does this. Well, that was, you know, the fact that she lived in a prosperous commercial city and the fact that she had ministered to Jesus would suggest that she was a woman of some means. See, I think, you know, I can't remember the fundies ever telling me that Mary was probably a fairly wealthy woman. Mary Magdalene was. She would, you know, all they would bring out was, well, she was demon possessed. Well, that doesn't mean she couldn't be wealthy. You know, there's a lot of really evil people out there with money. That doesn't mean anything. So it would appear, point E, that she had some position of supremacy among the women, as seen by the fact that she is named most often and is almost always named first. So typically when you think of people, you can't help yourself. Your mind works a certain way. And when you think of people, like you think of a couple, normally if the male is the dominant one in the relationship, you'll think of the husband first, and then you just do it automatically. You don't even think about it. You just think of the name that's the most prominent to you. And then sometimes it can be because of relationships. You know, you might think of them in opposite ways, like it's your sister and she's married. You know, you might think of your sister and then her husband. But typically speaking, when people do this, you do it without thinking about it. Very often you'll focus on what is the most prominent thing in your mind. What is the most prominent person? To me, it's always telling, you know, if I call somebody's home and the answering machine comes on and the wife is doing the recording and she says, "You've reached the wife and the husband." It tells me a little something, something. I know who's kind of probably more in charge in that house. I won't say. You figure it out. So again, she seems to have occupied quite a position in this group, which making her wealthy makes more sense, because the fact is, if she was contributing sufficient or even great financial things to Jesus, that would be very helpful for him. So F, she was present not only at the crucifixion, she was one of the two women that observed the burial and one of the first two witnesses at the resurrection. We're going to get that clearly in Mark 15:47 and 16:1. Contrary to the ridiculous theories of men like Joseph Ernest Renan, who lived in the 1800s, who was a philosopher and a supposed theologian. You just put theologian above your name and that makes you a theologian, I guess. That's all this guy did. Mary was not a nervous wreck. This is how he portrayed her. She was a nervous wreck, a woman with a weak will, and one who was disposed to hysteria and hallucinations. Okay, where do you get that in the text? Where does that come from? And yet, this is another way of explaining away the resurrection. Because if this is an hysterical woman at the grave, well, we can't trust anything she's doing. I've watched women get hysterical. They don't make good decisions. You know, they're crying, carrying on hysteria. They're not thinking clearly. And this is a way to undermine the resurrection. That's why he portrays her in this way. Not that there's any biblical evidence that she was that way. Because even though she was demon-possessed, if she was a prosperous person in a commercial city, there's no indication anyone would have known she was demon-possessed. I mean, unless she was doing a bunch of weird stuff. And as we pointed out in the early part of Mark, if you remember that first deal, when Jesus goes into the synagogue, there's a guy in the synagogue that's completely demonized. Nobody knows it. Everybody in that synagogue thinks they're there to worship, I guess. They think they're all the same. They're not. He was completely demonized, and he didn't come out till Jesus confronts him. Or the demon confronts Jesus. I can't remember which happened first, but it doesn't matter. Nobody knew. So again, to say, well, if a person's demonized, they're going to do all this and this and this and this and this. Well, you can't prove that. So I suspect there are some highly demon-possessed people at very high levels in our government, and they don't go on TV and act weird. You wouldn't know they were demon-possessed necessarily. But the fact is, they're into evil up to their eyeballs. Well, she was a woman that had benefited greatly from Jesus' ministry and appears to have been a loyal, faithful, and supportive follower to the very end. And the fact that she was present at the cross, even though she's withdrawn to a distance now, we know that. She demonstrated courage that the other male disciples did not. To characterize her as weak-willed is not logical or consistent with the text. And then Jay, the fact that she supported the Lord and ministered to him during his life will be accompanied by ministering to him in his death. And in my thinking, this demonstrates the characteristics of women at their best. To paint her in any way other than that, to me, is to not only do a disservice to her, it's to do a disservice to the very Word of God. The Bible does not portray her like that. So, again, we will have to stop there. Our time is up. And we'll deal with this more as we continue on here, which will be Thursday. You have Tuesday and Wednesday off. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us. In Christ's name, amen.